This is Menucha Talks, our new regular podcast, where we take some of the complex issues around motherhood and untangle them. I'm Rivki Dweck.
And I'm Friday Zanga. Together, we set up Menucha, the charity for peri and postnatal issues that affect mothers and fathers too. In today's episode, Behind the Mask, we're going to be speaking to Sarah, a former Menucha client who's agreed to talk to us about her journey through perinatal mood disorders and using Menucha services.
We have chosen to discuss this topic because just as we wear masks on Purim, for many women, struggling from perinatal mood disorders can be like wearing a mask all the time. In fact, I remember when we were setting up, another organisation told me that perinatal mood disorders can be considered as the smiling illness, as it is a time where mums can be at their most vulnerable, and yet it is also a time that they really want to show the world that they have it all together. And far from popular belief that having a perinatal mood disorder, for example, postnatal depression, means that you stay in bed all day and cry, which it can be for some women, most women go about their daily lives and no one would know how much they are falling apart behind their mask.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Could you just tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Hi, I am Sarah. I have two children and I came across Menucha a few years ago. Before my first child was born, I had a few years of infertility and saw a therapist then and all that. But when he was born, I had the most traumatic birth, as you often do with a first child. And I thought it would be fine, like nothing would happen. It would come and go and maybe babies would come and go and whatever. And then they came and they stayed and they stayed and they stayed and they stayed. And then COVID hit. So that was a blessing and a curse because I didn't have to leave the house, but my husband was home all day and I had a new-ish baby who was 10 months old. And at that point, I realized there was something not quite right because he was 10 months and I was still feeling really not myself, not great. When COVID started lifting, I went to see my GP and he diagnosed me with GAD, generalized anxiety disorder, but it wasn't quite that. It was more than that. And I knew in myself that it was more than that. And I don't think Menucha was up and running just yet by then. So I left it and I thought, oh, I'll be fine. I'll have another baby and that will heal me and all that. But I was wrong. I eventually got pregnant with another one. And at 4 months pregnant, I didn't want the baby, didn't want my husband. And yeah, that's when it's time to look for help.
When you say that you felt something was wrong, was it that you just weren't feeling your normal? Were there specific times? Was it all the time?
With my first,
yeah.
I had very bad mood swings. Like the rage was insane. Like I was screaming and shouting all day. I was neurotic as hell. Like you couldn't, I couldn't leave the baby with anyone. I didn't even want to leave him with my husband. Like I was that neurotic. Like at the same time, I felt I couldn't ask for help because I'd waited so long for this baby. How dare I complain? And that was the biggest thing that stopped me from reaching out. I just was like, there's no way I can ask for anyone's help and say like, oh my gosh, I'm still feeling this way and that way because my birth 10 months ago was terrible. Like I should have gotten over it. And I waited and I waited and I waited and I left it. So yeah.
Wow.
I think that feeling of I should be enjoying the moment. I'm so lucky to have a baby. It's something that a lot of people feel. Even people who, let's say, didn't have any, you know, trouble getting pregnant, they just feel like, you know, I'm so lucky. I got pregnant straight away. Like, how dare I deserve to feel unhappy about it? Mm-hmm. It's a feeling of guilt, really. Yeah.
There was a huge amount of guilt with that. And there was also a huge amount of like, I'll get pregnant, it will be fine, the pregnancy will be fine and smooth sailing, and then I'll have another baby and that birth will heal me. And there was that weight. But then there was also that I don't want to have another baby because what if the same thing happens again?
Yeah, when it comes to like traumatic births, people don't realise that you can be dealing with it for years and years and years. I remember I won't say which organisation, but we were setting up a training with a different organisation that helps women in the community. And I was explaining to the woman on the phone what we did. And she burst into tears. She must be about 50 something. And she said to me, you know that I've never been the same since my son was born 21 years ago.
Oh.
And
yeah,
Yeah, like that kind of waiting. One day it'll just go. Like a little bit like a cold, like it'll just go. And it's the reason why it's so important to reach out for help, and why it was so important for you to reach out for help, is because it doesn't go. Postpartum rage is a huge symptom for things not being right. It's a huge symptom of just having gone through an experience where you have been completely out of control.
Yeah.
Wow.
You said you had it during COVID. So I guess that wasn't going out much.
He was born before COVID. He was born like the year before, or year before. And like at the beginning, I was like that new mummy because like I had a new baby and I had a buggy, and like that was like my claim to fame. I'd finally had my baby. But no one realized. You could see me in the street and I was this happy mummy walking up and down with my buggy.
Yeah.
You wouldn't realize. My parents to this day don't know about it because they're old school. They don't believe in these kind of things. So to tell them that I'm feeling rubbish about having a baby, and my mum would be like, well, you had a traumatic birth and you've just got a baby and you probably don't sleep very well at night. And that would be her, that would be her.
That's the fix.
Yeah. You need to sleep. I mean, I haven't slept in a year and a half. My youngest one doesn't sleep. But I'm a normal human because I've gotten over my traumas. But I don't know. I just think that if you walk down the street, you really don't know. You really don't.
I think this is kind of the point of this whole podcast is to show people that you have no idea what your friends, what your family, what anyone is going through. And that, okay, there's two sides to it. One is that women should know that they're not alone in this. You don't have to hide it.
No.
And the other is have compassion. You know, you don't know what anyone else is going through. You know, they could be gorgeously dressed children, perfectly fed and homework done and whatever. Mm-hmm. And inside they're crumbling to pieces.
Yeah.
I found that I overcompensated with those kind of things. Like my kid would be clean and tidy and I wouldn't let him leave the house, the baby, until he was clean, tidy and dressed and the buggy looked perfect and everything like that. And then I would go out on the street and someone would meet me and say, oh, I haven't seen you in ages. And I'm like, deep down, I want to say to you, yes, because I hibernate in my house because I dare go out. Because the fear of going out is terrifying. But I can't say that to you. Like,
because it had to look perfect.
Because everything had to be perfect.
Yeah.
And I don't think I realized what I was doing until I came out of the whole like fuzz.
I had a similar experience, not with the children, but I never looked better. It was actually really weird. I couldn't talk to people. I looked amazing, like, and I really overcompensated. It was part of what had happened to me was I needed to look amazing all the time. And I remember the comments, wow, you look amazing. And I'm like, and I remember screaming inside, like, but I need help. Like, but yeah, you have absolutely no idea what is going on behind the mask.
Yeah.
Literally.
What did it take for you to call Necha?
I remember this really vividly. I was about 4 months pregnant, and there was one evening where I don't remember what it was about, and I know it was trivial, the most horrific blow-up with my husband. Now, he's non-confrontational, so he doesn't really discuss, like, go backwards and forwards. There's no arguing. It's very frustrating for someone who likes to argue. And I had this, like, absolute blow-up at him over something. I don't know what it was, but I know it was basically nothing. And I was sitting at the table just watching the world go by. And he came in and he's like, are you not coming to bed? And I'm like, no. Like, there's no way. I said, I don't want the baby. And I said, and you should leave me and find a new wife. And I remember saying that to him. And he looked at me, he's like, something's wrong. But it took me to get to the point of going, I know there's an organization called Menucha. I'm going to call them in the morning.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, when I've said that to myself, like, I'm going to ask for help tomorrow, or I'm going to do something tomorrow, it doesn't happen in the morning because you wake up feeling better, and I didn't. I woke up in the morning feeling the same rubbish, and I actually texted you. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember now.
Because I still had your number from when you started Menucha, and I texted you because I didn't want to ring the office, and I said, I've gone completely crazy. Like, I feel like a wild animal. I think I probably still have the messages, like, down at the bottom somewhere. And I said, I feel like a wild animal, like there's something's not right. The same day, like, you called me back and whoever, someone called me back. But within that week, I was seeing a therapist.
Yeah. It's always that first step that, you know, we always tell, we have an amazing team who answer the phones. They're all really well trained. And we always say to them, like, what it took for that woman to make that phone call, we know. you know,
I couldn't even do the phone call. I couldn't pick up the phone because I would have put the phone down like 6 times.
We've had
women that call up and just cry, and they can, and then we're like, they're not going to call back, and they call back a minute later and they start and then they cry.
Yeah.
And then, and we're like, always like, just call back when you're ready to talk and give them the other options.
Or we stay on the line while they cry.
Yeah, we do stay on the line whilst they cry.
We're there, but we know that that first step is the hardest one to make. It's the most challenging because you're actually admitting, you're admitting to yourself that actually it's gotten to the point where I need help.
Yeah, and I think I had to hit that like really low point where I told my husband to leave. I said, you can even find someone new to like to live with because I can't deal with this anymore. And I knew it wasn't me. It was almost like you're standing in a corner watching yourself behave like an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, it's an out-of-body
horrible
experience.
Thing.
It's a very common theme that we hear that. You're not you. You're watching your life happen. You're not in your life. You're like on top of it or like I said, in the corner and you just watch.
I used to watch myself have screaming matches and rage. And like the rage was when I really watched myself, weirdly. Like I would tell myself to stop screaming, but I couldn't because my body just wanted to scream.
Yeah, I always say that it felt like being like a monster taking over my body.
Yeah.
And I was like trapped in this tiny corner of my heart, like rattling the cages, but I had absolutely no control over what was going on at all. It's really, I think, losing, and I think that's why people are so scared of mental illness, because losing, you can't use your leg, it's terrible, and heart goes out to anybody that's struggling with these sort of challenges. But when you can't control your brain, which means you can't control your actions, that is the scariest thing, I think. I think it's one of the scariest things that people can go through. You just have no control.
Yeah.
No control whatsoever. And it's not for lack of trying. That's what's... And it's like...
You can't control it. Yeah. The same way you fall over and snap your leg in half. You've had a baby and your brain has snapped in half in a way. Yeah. And it's not something that you can control, except when you break your leg, you get lots of sympathy and everybody helps you and everybody looks after you. But after you have a baby, you know, 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later, it's kind of forgotten about.
Yeah.
Like you got your meals, you got your baby presents, you got your visits, whatever. And then it's kind of, you know, get on with it, you know, move on, carry on with life. But when you have a physical ailment, you get the help for as long as you need. It's a big difference.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about your journey through Menachah.
Sure.
So you mentioned that you texted Rivki. Yeah. So that is actually one of the ways that you can get in touch with us. You know, people who can't make that phone call, you can send us a message, you can WhatsApp, you can text the office number, you can send an email, message us through the website. There are lots of places on how to contact us. Also, we tell people you can deliberately call when the line is closed and leave an answer for a message. So you don't actually have to speak to anyone. What was that like when she answered you?
She answered me within like a minute or two. She said, I can't remember. I could find the message if you want. Should I find it? I'm sure I've got it somewhere. I wrote a whole long thing. But I said...
I like remember now.
I hope you don't mind me contacting you. I just really can't face calling the office. I don't know if it's something you Menachah deal with, but I'm pregnant again and I feel like the depression is back and the mood swings are awful. I need to get a handle on it before it gets worse, but I don't really know who to talk to. Is this something Menachah can help? And she replied, absolutely. 2 minutes later, by the way, what Menachah was made for, and we support pregnant moms with previous depression regularly. Would you like me to get our case manager to call you directly so you don't need to go through the office or help? And then I replied with thank you or whatever, and I wrote so grateful, feel like I've been turned into a monster. And she replied, it's so normal and happens to more of us than you think.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point.
Because that feeling alone that this isn't happening to anybody else, like again, that image of like looking down at all those mums on the green outside, just, you know, and I couldn't even, they thought I was weird. Like, I am anyway, but like they really like, okay. You know, I am definitely a circle in a square peg, but they thought I was weird. Like I was really, and I couldn't make conversation. And I was sometimes like inappropriate in what I said because I just was trying so hard to like just be normal, which wasn't usual for me. But that feeling like they're all managing and they all had little kids, but I couldn't manage was really difficult. And just sometimes that knowing that somebody else is there and understands and that this happens to more people than you think. It means okay, so this is something that can happen.
Yeah.
And once you have that revelation, it does change. It really changes everything.
When we formed Menacha, one of the models that we looked at was someone in America called Yad Rachel. Yeah. And she was telling us that they'd been going for, what, 20 years or something? Yeah. And they'd recently done their first in-person, you know, with women all together in a room. And she said that, was it two best friends walked in together and they saw each other.
Next door each other, I think she said.
Yeah, they lived next door each other. They had never known what the other one is going through. She said they were just like hugging each other and crying. Like there was somebody the whole way through who knew what they were going through, but they had never spoken to anyone about it. They could have had this support from the beginning. It's like, it just shows, first of all, that you have no idea what's going on next door. And also that it's so much more common that you know, if you think of all the WhatsApp groups that you're on, yeah? If one in four women have a perinatal mood disorder, think about how many people in your WhatsApp group have had it.
Yeah.
Right? So you're not talking small numbers here.
No.
It's so much more.
Just having that solidarity, say, with other people and knowing that you're not alone. I think that's something that we really wanted to get out there, which is why we push so heavily on like talking and conversation and the awareness and the small talks and the big talk. Just talk like And when we say talk, it does not mean about giving out all your secrets. It does not mean that people have to know all the nitty gritties of what's going on and your background and why this affects you so much, et cetera, and what the relationship is like between you and your husband and the babies or whatever. But just that becoming a mother wasn't easy for me. It's not easy for many women. And therefore, there's a lot of us out there and let's just get help and help each other. That was the idea.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that I gave you the name.
Mm-hmm.
We do that because we are a small community and we don't, and privacy is really important. Again, secrets is not a good thing, but privacy is really important. Yeah. And it's two different things. And what we want to avoid is somebody calling you who might live next door to you. So we really try to avoid that. And that's really why the case managers are so important, because they literally make sure that you don't go to somebody that you know.
But she said to me, she gave me Lejeva. I went to school with her. She's a few years older than me, but I went to school with her. And she said, but I really think she'd be good for you.
Yeah.
So try it and see. And if you're not uncomfortable to see her once, then see how it goes. And it was the best.
Yeah. Lejeva's amazing.
Yeah. It's also an issue that with, you know, within our community, we're a small community and we do have therapists from a different range of places. But let's say your case manager is going to check with you that you don't know who they are before she puts you with them. That's the number one important thing with us is that you have confidentiality. You know that nobody's going to know who you are. No one's going to know anything about you except for your therapist and your case manager. And we really make sure that, you know, everyone's like, every client who comes through gets a number, 4-digit number, 1234. And that is the only way you are ever referred to within Menacha. So, you know, I've had people come up to me at things and she goes, oh, you know, you're involved in Menacha. So I said, yeah. So she goes, oh, I went through Menacha. It was amazing. But you must know, right? I said, I have no idea who you are. And she goes, what do you mean? I was there for ages. I said, this doesn't make a difference. I don't know. Like, I haven't got a clue. She goes, what do you mean? But like, you know, I was invoiced for sessions and whatever. I was like, yeah, with your number. If you tell me your number, I'll be like, oh, I know how many sessions you had. But without your number, I don't have a clue who you are.
Yeah.
And I think
that's the same on the clinical side, by the way.
Like, yeah.
It's just numbers. So I could be sitting with someone and might know exactly everything as clinical manager about their journey. But unless they give me their number, I really wouldn't know who they are.
Wow.
And we're really careful.
Even you don't know.
Yeah. No,
we're
no
really,
one knows.
Really careful. We literally like.
I was convinced the two of you knew.
No.
No, not at all.
But I wasn't bothered because like I was at a point where I needed the help. So it doesn't matter who knows that.
So Rifki knew.
Right. If you give me your number, but I don't know what your number was.
But even after
you only knew because I texted you, kind of thing.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
right.
Only because that's the only way. The only person that gets your name is the case manager and then the therapist because they obviously refer to you by name. But that's actually on a separate paper to all the other notes,
oh,
and we do that specially because why should I have to know your name? We really like it's so important
it's true,
to us.
Because I met Chassi a few weeks ago, and she was saying to me, "I work at Menacha," and I said to her that she said you know about them. So I said, "Yeah, they saved my life." And she said, oh, I had no idea. Like, we really don't know what's going on. I said, no, you must know. Like, if you do the accounts, you must know when I've paid for my therapy. She says, no, I haven't got a clue. If you give me your number, I'll be able to tell you. Like, I'll be able to see how much you've paid.
Yeah.
But I do not know. And she's a good friend of mine. So, like,
the system, the way we set it up was we spent about 2 years setting up really.
Wow.
Really to ensure. Almost 3 years.
Yeah.
Really to ensure that when a woman comes through, there's no one who knows who she is. And that mm-hmm. and that even a good friend of yours who works in the office didn't have a clue that you were there.
No.
And so much so that I didn't even know who you were up until the point that you had agreed to do the podcast. Only then they shared your name with me. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's how, like, and even till then, even when we were discussing the podcast, it was that the client, it was never your name used.
That's really amazing, important though. To us.
That's really amazing.
I think people don't believe it because, yeah. like, whatever, like, you do tend to think of Jewish organizations as a load of yentas sitting around a yes. table. You do think like that. And we, from the onset, was like, no, we are going to run, like, better than an NHS service when it mm-hmm. comes to confidentiality and data protection. And that's how we run. And we pride ourselves on it.
And it I takes some convincing.
Right. People can call us like 4 or 5 times before they come on because they need to know the confidentiality. But I can promise people that we have pulled out every single stop when it comes to confidentiality. For example, we have a rule. If someone comes in and they say to the case manager, but I know Rifki, which has happened before, that case manager talks straight to the psychologist. The psychologist is the clinical manager for that case.
Right.
So I have no, we could have, family members and we don't know. We really, like, the women are the most important part of the work that we do. Yeah. And therefore we're very, very, very careful. And I do feel that we have to still convince people on that.
Yeah.
Because when you talk about a Jewish led organization, you tend to think of like, load of yentas walking, sitting around a table and discussing people.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't do that. We have women. We have supervision where we have amazing minds in our team and they can come up with different ways to help a client, which might be different to the therapist that they are actually mm-hmm. seeing. Even then, there's only a number used. And if there's any, and we go through who you might know in the team to make sure that if someone else might be able to guess who this number is, We don't bring it to supervision and we have private supervision for those.
Oh, wow.
So like we yeah. really, really pull out all the stops to make sure that women are not identifiable.
We've had even in supervision, one of the therapists saying, actually, I think, even without the name, I might know who it is. And she left. She mm-hmm. she leaves. Like,
wow.
That we're like, it's, yeah. it's very important to us.
So can you tell us a little bit about the actual journey through the therapy? Like at sure. what point, how did you feel after that first session? At what point did you feel that there was change? Did you see change? Was it constant? Was it regular? Therapy is, I think, quite a mystery to our community, to some people in our community. They believe it's where you bash your parents, which you might do, but that's not the point of it. It's where like a big deal is made out of small things. And I think that's something that we hear very, very often. Like, we just got on with it. Like, you could just get on with it. Like, why do you have to hash it out?
What did you get once? Pull your big girl knickers up.
Oh, yeah, we did get that. Shockingly from a midwife. Pull your big girl knickers up.
Birth trauma isn't a thing. I've had stories as well, which caused my part.
Right, exactly.
Part of my trauma, yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
I had a midwife who came after my baby was born, my first one. And I'd had a cesarean because the birth went wrong. And she said to me, well, if you'd had your baby in the Royal Free, then you wouldn't have had any problems and I would have delivered it. But she was so vile. And I said to her, like, do what you need to do and leave.
Yeah.
I said, I'm perfectly capable of feeding my baby and looking after my baby. Do what you need to do and leave.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That came up in our birth trauma podcast where people tend to think that birth trauma is the baby got stuck or there was a massive medical emergency and all the lights went on. For many women, the trauma is the midwife treating them like a piece of meat.
Yeah.
And them having absolutely no control over anything in that birth. No.
This was a home visit actually after.
Oh my gosh.
And she'd attacked me for that. The weird thing I was anxious about, I got through the birth and Baruch Hashem, it was much easier than the first. And I'd gone through my therapy, so I was much more in a better place. I was in a much better place. But when I came to like the breastfeeding thing, which I had an issue with my first, I said, I'm not doing it. I said, it's enough. It caused me enough trauma with the first. If there's one thing I can take out and make my life easier, he's going on a bottle from day dot, from the minute he's out. Again, it was the best thing I did. He did struggle with reflux and that kind of thing, but so be it for my mental health to be better. Mm-hmm. And I said to the midwives, maybe when I'm home, if I feel more comfortable, I'll try and breastfeed. And when I came home, I wasn't interested. And the community midwives who came were brilliant. And she mm-hmm. said to me, as long as you're mentally healthy, because she knew about my history. And she said, as long as you're healthy, I want mommy and baby to be healthy. I don't care how he's fed.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So she was a fantastic midwife.
It just shows that the midwives have a big impact on a woman's journey and a woman's emotions and feelings and really recovery, not only physically.
Yes,
definitely. She had a huge impact because had I had a midwife come to my house with my second and said to me, well, you must breastfeed because breast is best, I think I might have spiraled.
Yeah, because you are a really...
You're very vulnerable when you've given birth.
Yeah.
Especially when you're extra vulnerable because you've had perinatal... Because
you're like waiting to see if it will...
Yeah, is it coming back?
Yeah.
Coming back? And you're watching and 6 weeks go by and it's creeping up again and you're like, oh no, like stuff it back in sort of thing. But for that midwife to say that to me, and then I met her again because I took him to be weighed, and she was just fantastic, and she had such a good impact on me. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Like if I could book her for if I ever had more children, I would do that.
So can you talk us a little bit through the therapy journey? Like
sure.
When, like, what was it first like going into therapy? Had you had experience of therapy before, and then when did you like see that it was actually working? Because we said that people are a little bit skeptical that it actually works, but if you've been through it and you've had a good therapy experience, it's literally life-changing.
I have, like I said, I've done therapy in the past and I've always been left with that feeling that if you're not in it, you're not healing. Like, you've got to stay in it to keep going. And actually, that's what my GP said to me when I went to see him. He said, you either go on meds, which he gave me, or you stick in therapy for the rest of your life. And I didn't want that to happen again because I'd had that experience. But when I saw Elisheva, my first assessment session was life-changing because she said to me, look, we're going to do an assessment, but then next session we'll start. But she also started that session just to start, like, by talking, just by talking and letting things out, I started to feel a lot better. And then slowly, it was a very, very slow process, as therapy is, if it's done right. I think I started to see changes in myself. Now, other people may not have seen it in me, but I started to feel better. I was able to go out. Like, going to a kiddush on Shabbos was the worst thing for me. I didn't want to see people, and you have to make small talk, and I'm not good with small talk. So I just avoided everything. I would avoid family kiddushim. I would avoid anything. We live across the road from a shul, and if there was someone in there, like even the rabbi and Robertson, like if they made a kiddush, I just wouldn't go. Or I'd run in for 2 seconds and wish myself and run out, and she'd be like, but I haven't seen you in ages. And I'm like, but there's a reason for it. So slowly, slowly, I was able to start going out. I was able to start seeing people. I was able to socialize a bit. And then the rage calmed down, which was like the biggest thing there. It just sort of disappeared. And I used to call myself an anxious person. Like, I used to have quite high anxiety, like, most of the time. And I can honestly say now, I don't get anxious. Well, I do sometimes, but, like, I can handle it. And then also, I don't call myself an anxious person anymore. I don't class myself as having anxiety.
Wow. That is life. That's huge.
It's a huge thing. Because anxiety stops you from doing everything, like going out of your house. Like, it's my house is my safe place, and going out, even to just pick up my kid from school or from childcare or whatever, it was, I don't know, it just was like, I can't explain, but it just stops you from going to the shops, buying a loaf of bread. Like, what if someone's going to see me? What am I going to say to them? Like, what if they're watching me? Like, they're judging me on, like, what bread I buy or what kind of milk I buy or that kind of thing. Anxiety just tells you that it makes a problem for nothing. Yeah. And now I can see that, and I honestly can say, like, I'm good with buying a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
There's that feeling of safety and security. Mm. Wow. That's amazing. Can you tell us, like, how long did it take? How long were you in it for?
I was in it for a while because I was 4 months pregnant. So we took it from 4 months till the birth, and by the time I got to the birth, I was definitely well enough to be having the baby and healthy enough with the knowledge that I was going back into it at some point when he was better, when he was bigger. Definitely by the time I got to the birth, like the previous birth trauma was gone. But I think within about 6 weeks, I was a different person from the start to, yeah.
Was there anybody that recognized that? Like, was there anyone that, like, the mask sort of ripped off and...
No.
No.
Like I said, my family are really old school, so they don't see it.
Yeah.
My husband's not, he's a male, so he doesn't notice these things. Yeah. He doesn't notice these things. Yeah. I think if I sat down and said to him, like, do you notice a difference? He would probably say yes, but I'd have to, like, drag it out. I saw a difference.
Yeah.
I started to feel better. I wasn't anxious about going to therapy. I wasn't anxious about who I'd see when I went to therapy. And I think my kids saw a difference. I was a calmer mommy.
Yeah.
I can handle stuff that doesn't, I don't blow my head off when something spills or something like that. Like, the littlest things was making me lose it. And I do have a temper. I've been born with a temper. Hashem gave me that when I was born. But I can honestly say I can handle it now. Like, I can handle it better than most adults can handle theirs because
you're in control.
I'm in control of it. Yeah,
that being in control is everything.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
I've taken control.
Yeah.
I guess so.
The main thing that we want to do is empower women to take control. I think it becomes very difficult when people come in and don't want to do the work because there is an element of a client having to take accountability and really wanting to change and hear. Mm-hmm. I mean, therapists are not, they don't give advice, but they really help you explore those deep, dark places. And it's uncomfortable. It can be really uncomfortable. And sometimes you have to face your, like, biggest demons. But if you're willing to work with it, then you are the one that's done the work. It's not the therapist is like the facilitator, but it's the client that's done the work. And that's, I think, what Menachah's main aim is that to empower you to take control. Mm-hmm. Like, literally what you said, Friday, to take control. Do you have any sort of reflections looking back, like just overall thoughts about the journey?
Well, I actually have one. Before she starts, I think that the fact that you saw the change in your journey is beautiful.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, even though nobody else knew what was going on and therefore there was no outside, well done for changing, well done for doing what you're doing, you saw it in yourself.
Yeah.
And you realized that it was a positive thing. And I think that's all anyone could ever want, is that who cares what everyone else thinks of me? You know, you saw yourself in a better light. You helped yourself.
Mm-hmm. And that leads into things that we spoke about in our last podcast and in the one with Elisheva. I don't know if you heard the one with Elisheva, which is self-worth.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
You recognize that you yourself are worthy.
And everyone should have that.
Yeah, that you are worthy and you're inherently worth being well and managing life. And you gave yourself that chance.
I think as a mum, you kind of, as soon as that baby is born, that kind of goes out the window, that self-worth, because you're focusing solely on your children.
Yeah.
And as big as a bracha is, you do lose yourself having children. But again, the reason why it took me so long to ask for help was because I'd waited so long for him, my first, and I'd completely lost myself. I was immersed in mummy and being mummy, and that was it. I'd lost my sense of being a wife completely. It was like, and I used to shout at my husband and say, you're not priority anymore. He's priority, you're not. And it was probably the worst thing I ever said to him, because it was like showing him that actually he's not important. But also I'm showing myself that I'm not important anymore because I'm solely focusing on being mommy to this child. You really lose yourself. Yeah. And coming back into that and saying, actually, I need that help is, I guess it's giving you that self-worth again, isn't it? Because you're giving yourself a chance to heal better.
Yeah.
What would you say to your friends now, you know, to look at, like, you know, as a friend who's gone through it, you know, I went through, you didn't even realize, nobody noticed. Or did you notice that I went quiet for a while?
I lost all my friends in that time. And as an adult, it's impossible to make friends. I'm quite introverted, so even harder to make friends. But the ones who were still around, sort of thing, when I came out of it, I actually convinced one to go and get therapy, and she did. I said to her, go and talk to someone. She said, it's really interesting. I never was able to pick up the phone and call and ask for help. And it's taken you, because you've done it, to ask for help. And she did. And she always says, like, she says to me, you saved me. I remember her telling me about her first call, and she said she just picked up the phone and sobbed.
once you understand that healing journey and how powerful it is,
yeah,
it has a ripple effect on all of those people around you.
Yeah.
That's why I talk a bit too much about these things.
No such thing as too much. Yeah.
I talk about my fertility journey as well. And I'm like, people don't realize we waited 4.5 years for kids. And it's not a long time if you look back on it and you go, it's not a long time. But it depends on a lot of things. If you're growing up in a family where everyone pops babies every 5 minutes, yeah, which my husband's family do, and there's everyone giving you these little snippets of advice and go here and go there and learn after the Seder night, which is what we had. If you learn after Seder night, you'll get it's a simon bracha or whatever it is. And if you drink this and if you do that and if you do this, and it drives you mad. But 4 years doesn't look long if you look back on it, but it's the longest time to go through. Yeah, if you put it that way.
Yeah.
It's the longest time to go through when you're losing pregnancies and you can't hold a pregnancy and you don't know why, you don't know what's going on and you don't know why. And, but like,
yeah,
there's so much that kind of that probably feeds into the trauma of after having the baby, which was probably the birth was just a trigger. It was like, now we're going to set her off. Like the little demons in my head were going.
Because you were on survival mode.
Because I've been on survival mode for 5 years.
Wow. That's really difficult.
So that's why I talk.
Yeah.
But I think it's important because then friends like you had should know that, you know, when your friend does go quiet or does disappear off the face of the earth, follow them. Find out where they've gone. You know, you might not get a response back, but even that message, hi, thinking of you, you know, if you're up for going out, let me know, or drop off a cake Erev Shabbos or something. If your friend disappears off the face of the earth, it happened for a reason.
Yes.
Check on them.
Yeah.
Make sure they're okay. You know, past that 6-week mark when everyone's forgotten about them, you know, and your friend hasn't made contact or she hasn't surfaced, send her a message. Hi, just checking on you. How's the baby?
Mm-hmm.
That's all it needs.
Yeah.
The knowledge that someone is there for you, even if you don't respond.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Sarah, for coming and talking with us. I really think lots of people are going to learn from this, and hopefully it will spur other women to come forward for help. So if you do want to carry on the conversation or find out more about what we can do and how we can support you, get in touch with us. You can call us anonymously on 0300-222-5764. Or if you prefer to send us a message, you can email us at office@menucha.info. We listen, we care, we're here, let's talk.